A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 18, 1999, in the series Moving On to Maturity, entitled Religion, Binding or Setting Free. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 46, verses 1 through 7, Ephesians 1, verses 15 through 23, and Matthew 23, verses 1 through 15. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Well, I hope you got up this morning and said, Sunday, we get to go to church. If you got up and said, it's Sunday, we've got to go to church, I hope you feel a little guilty for about 5 minutes, but not much longer than that. Religion ought to be an experience of joy and liberation. And Sunday worship ought to be the crown of it all, the time when we find inspiration and encouragement and new reason to live zestfully. I find that what I'm dealing with this morning pops up on my charts quite often. The fact that religion ought to be a source of freedom. I would like to be known as a singer of the song of the soul set free. Some Lents ago, I preached a rather strange sermon, admittedly. It was a sermon about the insurrectionist that was crucified with Jesus. Now, not the good one, you know. Everybody preaches on the good one. After all, the good one pleaded for mercy in the end and got this wonderful promise from Jesus. But I preached on the one that remained belligerent, cursing through his teeth to his last breath, finding therein something I thought rather heroic. I suppose because of my own libertarianism and contrarianism, perhaps. But I thought it was probably not biblically accurate, but interesting. However, someone got really angry with me about that and came in to see me and said to me, all you preach is freedom and grace. And in my work, I find out that what people need are rules and guidance and discipline. And it was a moment of awakening for me. I think I didn't react defensively. I just smiled and I said, well, they won't get it from me. And it was a moment of awakening wherein I recognized that I am not a complete preacher. No one has ever accused me of balance. I think balance is boring. And balance ends up making no point deeply. And I can't be everything. I have been shaped in a certain way, have had certain kinds of experiences, and that has enabled me to put my finger on what I discern is a very important niche to be filled. That is to seek to save people from religion, to set people free from religion, especially religion. And I have been doing that now for a long time. And as this morning we continue in this series, moving on to maturity, I simply want to say what I've said here many times, but find that needs to be said again and again. because there is something intrinsic in religion that tends to bind and cripple the human personality rather than setting a person free. And so this morning, let me say, I am the herald of good religion that releases and sets free. And I would speak a word against that religion that binds the soul and becomes a burden to be borne. Because there is a lot of religion that way. We need to recognize how religion arose in the first place. It didn't just drop down out of heaven. And it is not something that God gave to us, but it is something that we have created in our attempt to respond to God. In the early beginnings of what we call the human, the beginnings of consciousness, of self-consciousness, there was the growing awareness of one's existence. How fragile it is, how perilous it is. And inevitably, with the emergence of the human come questions of meaning and of purpose. From whence have we come? And whither are we going? And what is the meaning of it anyway? Life, with its passages and its perils, is not easy to negotiate. And in the early dawning of human consciousness, these deeply existential questions began to be asked. And then someone saw a bush that burned and wasn't consumed. Someone entered the temple and it was filled with smoke and the pillars of the temple were shaking. Someone looked at a man and said, the Lamb of God. Someone was going on the road to Damascus and a bright light encountered him and a voice spoke to him. In our own tradition, but we could duplicate that in all the great religious traditions. There was someone sometime who had some kind of experience, and to the extent that experience spoke to the reality of his or her situation. And to the extent that as it was shared, it resonated with the experience of others, there was a gathered community, and then a gathered community that became a tradition. And that experience was reduced to a teaching and a ritual through which one worshiped and a way of life. And so we have the great religions that are based on a founding experience and have taken on a certain institutional form. And those great religions continue to serve people as life maps, to give orientation, to answer those ultimate questions of life as we live in the mystery of our existence before that ultimate mystery that bears us. That's the nature of religion. If you were here in May when we welcomed our eighth graders into the continuing pilgrimage of faith, you heard me say to them that all we could give to them was secondhand religion. And that really is what institutional tradition, traditional religion is. It's secondhand religion. And I quoted the statement of William James in his Varieties of Religious Experience, who said, such a ordinary religious person has his religion, has been made for him by others, communicated to him by tradition, determined to fixed forms by imitation, and retained by habit. And that's really true when you think about it. There is the experience that someone else had. There's the tradition that conveys it. There is the form by which it is fixed by imitation or repetition, and it continues by habit. And so most of us are what we were born to be. We are within the tradition and that understanding with which we were born and nurtured. And our religion is secondhand. Now hopefully it becomes the occasion for fresh experience, for firsthand experience. But institutional religion is, after all, a commodity which inevitably tends in its institutional forms, which are necessary, it tends to become a burden rather than that which lifts the burden. It tends to become another obligation for which we feel responsible. And it becomes burdensome. Second Isaiah, with the Jews in exile in Babylon, gives us a marvelous picture of religion that has become a burden. Bel and Nebo were the chief gods of the Babylonians. And the Jews in exile would see on New Year's Day the grand processions, maybe like Mardi Gras, where the images of the gods would be taken down from their pedestals and taken on parade around the walls of the city. And the problem with the Jews in exile was that it seemed to them that these gods must be the chief gods, because where was their God? They were in exile. They were in captivity. So the prophet has to remind them that their God is the creator of the heavens and the earth. He has to have them remember who their God really is. And in drawing this picture with a little satire and humor, he pictures the gods, the pedestal, the images of the gods being taken from their pedestals and put on beasts of burden and carried out of town, not in a New Year's feast now, but because the enemy is at the gate. And what they're trying to do is save their gods. Now, if you don't get a little laugh out of that, you see, their gods are going into captivity. They've got to rescue their gods. For God's sake, they've got to take care of their gods. And the prophet says to them, look, look at them, carrying off their gods in order that they not be taken into captivity, and their gods, their images, they can't say a word, and they can't save. They become a burden to be borne. And then in contrast to that, he sets forth these words from the Lord. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, who have been born by me from your birth, carried from the womb, even to your old age, I am God. Even when you turn gray, I will carry you. I have made and I will bear, I will carry and I will save. God is not a God that needs to be rescued or a burden to be borne, but a God who carries, a God who lifts, a God who rescues, and a God who saves. Now we can laugh at the silly Babylonians for putting all that stock in those images that they put on beasts of burden. Can't you see the idol sort of tipping off because the poor old beast can't handle it, and it drags its nose in the dust as it's going out of town in order to be rescued? And we can laugh at that, and the prophet intended this satire to be biting. But our religion so easily becomes that. Take, for example, the church. Ask me about the church. Not so easy to keep the machinery going. Not so easy to keep the budget up to snuff. And then all of the programs of the church. How many pulpit announcements don't jerk you just a little bit? Add just a pinch of guilt. And if you didn't get up this morning and say, oh, thank God it's Sunday, I get to go to church, maybe you say, God, what a beautiful summer day. But I suppose we better go to church. There was poor old Dick slaving all Saturday, and he's going to sit on his stool and nobody there. We better go. There's so many good people who support religion for all the wrong reasons. I've known a lot of good church leaders that way. They remind me of what Mark Twain said, a good man in the worst sense of the word. I think about that. How much, you know, and I do thank God for responsible people and serious people and people who bear the burden and heat of the day and who keep it going, but I got to tell you, it can turn religion into a burden. And it misses the intention. It makes religion an end in itself rather than a means to the end of setting the soul free and finding a way to sing and shout and dance. Religion is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. And when it becomes organized and institutionalized and established well, it becomes something that has to be kept up. And you just look around us today and all the stuff about religion in the newspapers. We want to plaster the Ten Commandments on every wall in the schools and in the courts. We want to have children pray in school. Why? Because we're so concerned about the spiritual life of people, or because we think the morality of the nation is unraveling and we've got to get the Ten Commandments up there, and we've got to get children praying, and we've got to expose them to all this. We've got to use religion, because if we don't use religion, society's going to deteriorate. And that makes religion rotten. It makes religion used. It makes religion an end in itself. And it sours us. Religion used for any other purpose and the worship of God, dancing before God who sets the soul free, is bad religion. Good for family values, good for community values, good for maintaining the civilization in the West. And all of that misses the point, and all of it abuses and misuses religion, and all of it makes religion a burden to be borne. Even in the church, my philosophy over the years of programming has been, do only as much as you have to. Do those things. I never try to scratch where people don't itch. The things that will meet human need are the things that will be supported. People will be there. And otherwise, you've got this elaborate program, and you're pleading with people to do these good things that we've got for you. The whole society today is organizing all kinds of good things for me to do that I don't want to do. I don't need to do them. And the church can be as guilty, and maybe more guilty than any other social organization, in providing all sorts of stuff. And it becomes a burden. And the more serious you are, and the more conscientious you are, the more you are inclined to support this project. It's like the PTA. Everybody ought to support the PTA. Everybody ought to support, you know, the United Fund. Everybody ought to support Boy Scouts in America. Everybody ought to support the cancer drive, whatever drive there may be. And for God's sake, we ought to support the church. A community needs a church. It makes it for a good community. It just makes for better people. And it misses the point completely. It's like the Babylonians hoisting their gods off the pedestals onto beasts of burden and trying to guide them, keep them from falling, and get them out of town so they can save their gods. That kind of religion, I don't think anybody here is into this, into that kind of religion, or I wouldn't say this. But if there should be one pilgrim from outer space into that kind of religion, what you need is a sabbatical. Just take off for a while. Get your system cleansed of it. Because you'll never be able to enjoy God forever if your religion is heavy with obligation under the tyranny of the ought, the must, and the should. Jesus certainly knew that. When I read the 23rd chapter of Matthew, as other gospel passages, I always want to say the controversy in that chapter is probably between Matthew and those that he was in conflict with, more reflective of that than Jesus and his time. Although certainly Matthew was reflective of the spirit of Jesus and the intention of Jesus. And one of the things that Jesus, one of the reasons he got into such serious trouble was that he didn't support that kind of institutional religion that had become a burden. And in the passage, the 23rd chapter of Matthew, we read, you bind heavy burdens on people that they cannot bear, and you don't yourself. He said, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. So when they teach, they're teaching you Moses, the Mosaic tradition, that's fine. But don't do as they do. And in the conclusion to that chapter, he says, woe to you. You go all over the world to make a proselyte, and once you've got a proselyte, you've made him twice over the child of hell, binding heavy burdens on people, trying to make them religious. And all of it turns upside down what it's really all about, which is setting the soul free. Jesus was so strong against the conventional wisdom of his day that put people in their places and through their paces. And he violated all of the taboos in the interest of people, with that sense he had of the graciousness of God. What we do with bad religion is scandalize God. What kind of a God is it anyway? A stern, demanding parent who created us and then keeps us in our adolescence, treating us as naughty children. The biblical paradigm of paradise and fall adds to that. We're guilty sinners. Are we guilty sinners? Well, let's go to Kosovo. Or let's look into our own hearts. Of course we are. But not because we have fallen from some pristine perfection, but because we are still clawing our way out of the jungle. And we haven't made as much progress as we should have made. But I'll tell you what, that stern, demanding father doesn't help any. Rather, it binds us in our rebellion, and it keeps us in our immaturity. God is for us. This is what Paul was trying to say. If I had had more time this morning, I could have read the whole first chapter of Ephesians, those first 14 verses, fairly sore. As Paul talks about the eternal, everlasting grace of God, his loving us, knowing us before the foundations of the world, and working things out according to his purposes. It's a grand, grand passage. And then Paul comes to address his people in Ephesus personally, where he says, and so I pray for you. Oh, I pray for you that the eyes that God will enlighten the eyes of your understanding, that the inner being will be illumined, that you might come to know what is the hope to which he calls you, what is the riches of the inheritance in which is yours, what is the power available to you, the very power of resurrection. Paul says, oh boy, I hope you're getting it. I pray to God that he'll help you to see it. You see, Paul was the one that had that founding vision. Paul had his soul on fire, and he said to these people, it's so grand. The grace of God, it is so big, so rich, so wonderful. Oh, I hope you come to see it. But when religion is used as a means for everything else, then dancing before God, it becomes a burden to be borne rather than a gift to be celebrated. And it binds the human soul rather than setting free. C.S. Lewis understood, and I want to say this clearly this morning, that there are religious observances that are important and helpful. Talking about religious observances, which I've been rather hard on this morning, C.S. Lewis said, when we carry out our religious duties, we are like people digging channels in a waterless land, in order that when at last the water comes, it may find them ready. There are happy moments even now when a trickle creeps along the dry beds, and happy souls for whom this happens often. And I know, obviously I know, that there are certain religious observances that we go through, and sometimes going through them, there's no electric shock, no lightning strikes, but we do have a pattern of religious life. And we do that because we know that now and again, here and there, there will be a trickle of water, fresh breath, new insight, deep resting in grace. And so we keep coming, and we keep opening ourselves, and we keep practicing. But all the time we know, it's not to keep the community healthy or the nation sound or our accounts square with a stern, demanding God, heavenly parent. But we do it because now and again we've tasted grace. We know the taste of cool running water, and we long more and more to be lifted by that experience. There was once a pastor here, not I, no present team member, I should say, who had a little boy who used to come down from Parsonage to the study on the parking lot here every morning, say to his father, who was the preacher pastor, Daddy, what day is it? Father would say, Tuesday. Oh, good. Come down again. Daddy, what day is it? Thursday. Oh, good. Saturday. Good. Sunday. He would go into a wailing temper tantrum. Sunday. Ugly Sunday. Well, God has special grace for preacher's kids. I mean, and the preacher was stern enough of a father and demanding enough of a heavenly parent type that he broke the child's will, and the child eventually came to church. But that story always amused me, because I think it reflects the experience of many of us growing up. Sunday, church. But I'll tell you what, you don't have to come. But come when you need to. Come like digging out channels in a waterless land. Just maybe, there will be a trickle of water. And if it's rules and guidance and structure that you need, check down the street. But if you need a shot of grace, I'll see you every Sunday.